Thank you, Shu. Thank you to Torah in Motion for giving me the opportunity to continue to engage in Torah study with you all. And we are going to jump right in. For those who are joining us for the first time or less familiar with what I'm about to do, I will work off a screen share of the text as well as the source pages. The source pages are posted on the chat, so you are welcome to open it up that way if you wish, or download it and print it in advance. I usually post the morning of. However, I will be sharing on the screen all of the text that you'll need for this course. That's number one. Number two, I've kind of looked at Sefer Daniel on two levels. One is as a Sefer as a whole, and we're going to be studying the whole, Mirtz Hashem, studying the entirety of Sefer Daniel. But the other way to look at it was to kind of divide it up into sections. And so although it's going to seem like we're in the midst of a middle of a unit, which in some ways is true, but in some ways it's not, there's a reason for starting at this particular point, which is the kind of conclusion of chapter three. And I will do a quick summary of where we're at. And then our focus for this next unit is going to be on the historical time period of the Babylonian era, meaning under the Babylonian rule, and Daniel and his friends and their experience under all of different kings of Babel. And then the latter half of the book will focus primarily on Persia and the influence and the experience under the beginning of the Persian rule, Koresh and Dayavish, which are also part of Daniel's experience. So that's by way of introduction. We've spent the first third, if we will, or the first unit of this course, focusing a little bit on the background, the exile, the experience of exile, what it means to go into exile, and the challenges that the nascent young Jewish community of Bavel finds itself in, particularly Daniel and his friends, who are at the beginning of the book very, very young and children, and kind of experiencing growing up under the Babylonian influence, and very quickly emerge because of their loyalty to God and loyalty to Torah, emerge in a kind of a unique position within the Persian experience. And with that, we're going to jump right into our study of this story. I just need to do a few little housekeeping things. Okay. Where we are at right now is we had started chapter three. Now, much of, kind of reorient, much of the book of Daniel, the middle parts of the book of Daniel, are written in Aramaic, and that becomes just an added challenge for us. And so many translations will either translate into English or into Hebrew. And I like to actually work off the Hebrew and English rather than the Aramaic and English, because it just has more of a familiar Tanakh ring to it, even though it is a translation. We understand that Hebrew and Aramaic are much more akin to each other grammatically and just want to check something. And syntactically than English, and so it's much easier to do a word for word translation from the Aramaic to the Hebrew and work off that. And so we had started a look at chapter three. Chapter three is a very familiar story. Nebuchadnezzar makes a giant statue of gold, 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide, and places it in the valley of Dura in Bavel, and commands everybody in his kingdom to bow down to this statue of 60 cubits high, made of pure gold. And he gathers all of the governors and prefects and judges, etc., to a one big enormous gathering with music and instrumentation, etc. And he commands everybody to bow to this statue, to tipluv tis gedul etzelem azahav, to fall down and worship and to bow to this gold statue that Nebuchadnezzar had established. And everybody does, with the exception of three Jews by the name of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, Daniel's friends, they refuse to do so. And the story is most familiar because of its conclusion, Nebuchadnezzar's threat to all of the people was that whoever doesn't bow down to the statue will be thrown into the fiery furnace, l'toch kivshan ha'esh ha'ba'aret. And there are three Jews, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, their Babylonian names, who refuse to do so. And they come and there is reported to the king that, I'm just jumping through because we read the perek, we read through the text at the end of the last quarter. So we're just going to, I just want to zero in on one question, which will be the subject for today. And so Nebuchadnezzar kind of pulls them and he says to them, is it true that you won't bow down? If you don't bow down, I'm going to throw you into the furnace and let God try to save you. If you don't bow down, you will be thrown into the furnace. And who is the God who is going to save you from my hands? To which they answered and said, Anu Shadrach, Meshach, Ve'avad, Nago, Ve'amim, Nebuchadnezzar, lo tzichim anachnu al davar zeh la'shiveka. We don't need to answer you. We don't need to deliberate with you. Im yesh Elokeinu asher anachnu ovdim yachol la'atzilenu mikivshan ha'esh ha'ba'eret u'miyadcha ha'melech yatzil. If God chooses to save us from this furnace, so be it. Ve'im lo, but if not, yadua yelecha ha'melech ki le'lo'echa en anachnu ovdim u'letzelem ha'zahav asher ha'rekimota lo nizgod. If not, then know, Nebuchadnezzar, that we will not bow to your, I'm going to actually read the translation here, we will not serve your gods, nor will we worship your golden image. And previously we had explored this from a literary perspective and compared it to the story of the Tower of Babel and Abraham in the fiery furnace and the Medrash and the role that the Medrash played in terms of connecting the stories. That was all the previous unit. If you were with us, great. And if you were not and you're interested, the recordings are all posted. However, what I want to pick up on here, and this will be important for us as a new subject kind of moving forward, is the question of what is the status, legal, halachic status of this statue, and whether or not Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were, let's call it, correct. Let's ask the question bluntly. Were they correct in risking their lives and sacrificing their lives in refusing to bow down to this statue, which of course connects to the first question, what is the nature, what is the status of this statue? There are many instances that we know in history of Jews putting their lives on the line, sacrificing their lives for the sake of Judaism, for the sake of Torah, for commitment to Torah, what we call Kiddush Hashem, to die for the sake of the sanctification of God's name. However, and this may come as a surprise to us, for most of, I'm going to just stop sharing for a second, in most instances, this is a post-biblical phenomenon. Meaning, in Tanakh itself, it is very rare to find a culture, a civilization, that sees as its mandate a kind of zealotry with regards to its pagan idolatrous beliefs, forcing others to bow down at the pain of death. The notion that is a notion that starts much later in the context of Hanukkah and the time of the Maccabees, and it has its ramifications in the Roman time period, certainly under Christian rule, and certainly in other cultures. But in the world of Tanakh, pagan cultures tended not to be that zealot. Not that zealous, and that intent on forcing others to bow down to their gods. And so the notion of, on pain of death, bowing down to an idol is not something which we find commonly in Tanakh. Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, really the only instance that we have explicitly. There's another famous instance that comes to mind, but it's complicated. And that, of course, is Mordechai and Megillat Esther. There it's complicated because the command is to bow down to Haman. Haman is not an idol. Haman is a person. And so there's a great deal of discussion as to whether or not Mordechai was justified in not bowing down to Haman. What was the conflict? What was the issue? Please God, maybe one day we'll study Megillat Esther and we'll explore that as well. But here, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah asked to bow down to a statue made out of gold. And they put their lives on the line and said, we won't do it. And if you force us, we will allow ourselves to be thrown into the fiery furnace. The Medrash will link it back to the story of Abraham, who was the first, but that's Midrashic. That's much later in time. In the context of Tanakh, it's a very rare instance. That is question number one in this context. Question number two, which is no less significant, is Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah stand up to Nebuchadnezzar and say, we will not bow down. What about everybody else? What about the rest of the Jewish people? What about Daniel? The oddity, one of the oddities in the story is that Daniel is nowhere to be seen. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are front and center. Daniel, who is prominent in chapter one, together with his friends, prominent in chapter two, is nowhere to be seen in chapter three. He will appear again in chapter four and the remainder of the book. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah actually disappear from the rest of the book. That's less bothersome to me than the fact that Daniel is not here. And the Medrash also addresses that question. So I want to start with a basic core halachic discussion, which is, what is the status of this statue? And the ramification is, from a halachic perspective, if we deem it to be idolatry, big golden statue represents a deity of some kind and therefore is paganism and idolatry, then I understand what Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are doing. Because as we know, there are three prohibitions for which a person is obligated to give up their life rather than violate, and one of them is idolatry. On the other hand, then I ask the question, so where are the rest of the Jewish people, and are they bowing or they're not bowing? Are they guilty of idolatry or not? Mystery. Leave for a moment. So that's the focus of our discussion today, and perhaps a little bit next week as well. The reason why this is so important for us to understand at the beginning, at the outset of the continuation of this discussion, is because it will become a theme that will thread through the rest of the book of Daniel. The implications and the ramifications of what happens here will continue to reverberate for the rest of the Sefer and maybe even beyond. And so it's a very foundational piece to wrap our heads around and understand. So we're going to divide this up into schools of thought. Let's start with the simplest. School of thought number one is, let's call it a classic approach. Statue of 60 cubits high to which Nebuchadnezzar says, made out of pure gold, in which Nebuchadnezzar says, everybody bows down. What else could it be except a golden statue, a golden idol, and that's what we call idolatry. And that is certainly the position of a host of sources, and we're going to start looking at those sources now. So I'm going to go back to sharing this screen. Come back to this in a moment. Let's jump to the source page. Gemara and Megillah. This Gemara happens to be dealing with a question from the, with regards to Purim, which is not our subject for today, but it tangentially connects. Shalu Talmidav to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. The students asked Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Mipnimani Tchaivu Sonehem Shay Yisrael Shabirato Ador Klaya. From a certain theological perspective, the Jews in Haman's generation in the time of Ahasuerus must have deserved some kind of punishment because they were threatened with annihilation. What did they do to deserve this from a Tanakh perspective? Amar Lahem, to which he said to his students, Shimon ben Yochai, Emuatem, why don't you tell me what you think? Amulo, so they said, Mipnation Enum Isulatosha, because the whole Megillah starts with the fact that there's this big feast, and the Jews must have been participating in that feast. We'll see later in the Medrash and Shir Hashirim even spells it out further that there was a feast, the food wasn't kosher at that feast. Okay. Says Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, Imkein, Shabashushan Yehargu, Vishabachol Olam Kulo Al Yehargu. So that only applies to the Jews of Shushan. What about everybody else? Amulo. So they said back to Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai, so Moratah, so you tell me, why did the Jews deserve to be destroyed? Amalahem, Mipnei Shehishtachavu Letzalam. Because they bowed down to Nebuchadnezzar's idol. And Rashi The Gemara doesn't say Nebuchadnezzar. Rashi adds Bimei Nebuchadnezzar. In other words, according to this Gemara, and again, it's a Midrashic piece, but the Gemara links the consequences of the story of Purim, which happened under the Persian rule, which is just a few years later, to the roots of that degeneration and idolatry and assimilation, which starts with the Jews bowing down to Nebuchadnezzar's statue. And this is fleshed out a little bit more in the Medrash and Shir HaShirim Rabbah, where it's clear that the reference here is A, to Nebuchadnezzar, B, to our story of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, and the conclusion being that they are the only three who stood up to Nebuchadnezzar. Everybody else was willing to bow down. Medrash and Shir HaShirim Rabbah, similar approach to this. It even identifies the same conversation, Rabbanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai. Just FYI, the Medrash reverses the opinions. So, but that's a not our subject. Rabbanan amre al she'avdu, imkem lama bau Yisrael b'safek b'mei Haman, why were the Jews threatened in the days of Haman? Says Rabbanan, because avdu Yisrael avadat kochavim, because Israel worshipped idols. And Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai is the one who here in this Medrash is attributed with the opinion that says, because she'achlu tavshil goyim, they ate non-kosher food. What is the machloket here? Al dat Rabbanan amru avdu avdei kochavim. The Rabbanan said they worshipped idols. Ketzad, how does that come about? Nebuchadnezzar hemid tselem. Nebuchadnezzar built this big statue. Ve'efrish esrim u'shlosha mikol uma v'oma. And he took 23 representatives of every nation. Ve'esrim u'shlosha mikol Yisrael, and 23 from Israel as well. And therefore, when Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah were the only three who refused to bow down, the implication is three refused and the other 20 publicly bowed down to this statue. Hence, Avdu Yisrael Avodat Kochavim. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai's position here is that they did not worship idols. Why not? Because there were not 23 people representing every nation, but rather only three. U'shloshamikol Yisrael, and those three were Hanani, Mishael, Azariah, and therefore they refused, so therefore there's no precedent for them having worshipped idols. In other words, from my perspective, I'm not interested right now in the machloket about Purim. I am interested in the perspective on this statue. Both the Rabbanan and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai in this Gemara assume that the statue was some kind of idolatry. The only distinction and dispute there is, did all the Jews bow down and just Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah refused, or did Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah refuse on behalf of all of the Jewish people? But everybody agrees in this passage that the statue was classic idolatry, and therefore what they were being asked to do was to worship idols, and that's one of the big three, Areg Val Yavor, to which you have to be willing to sacrifice your life. And they were so willing, and they did exactly what was expected of them, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, the rest of Israel, if they were so inclined to bow down, it was in violation of this principle. That's the position of the Gemara and Megillah. That's the position of the Medrash and Shir HaShirim Rabbah. It's quoted this way in Halacha in a number of sources, including the She'ilta to Rav Achagon. For the sake of your own education, if you're interested, for many of these sources, I've given you a little biographical information on the bottom of the source page. I'm not going to spend time on it now in the Shir, but you're welcome to look at it afterwards. Rav Achagon is more or less the end of the 7th century, beginning of the 8th century, first half of the 8th century. She'ilta de mechayvim beit Yisrael lemimsa nafshayu al kedushat Hashem de kudsha brichu. The position, the ruling, that Israel is obligated to give their life up for the sake of the sanctification of God's name and not worship idols. This doesn't have a translation, I apologize. I'm just going to translate it as we go. The iluman da ansin le avodat kochavim, the amin lo kfor bemilti dishmayo falach le avodat kochavim, the lo katlin halacha, mechayev le mimser nafshe le katla, velo liflach avodat glilim, which in Aramaic basically says exactly what we just said. Anybody who's so told that they should worship idols and give up their faith should be willing to give up their life rather than worship idols. And that's exactly what we find, says Rav HaGaon, in the story of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, that Nebuchadnezzar, the wicked, established a great tzelem, a great statue made out of gold, and decreed lemiflach lei, to bow down to it, to worship it, and masru nafshayu, and they were willing to sacrifice their lives. So this is what I would say a fairly straightforward reading of the text, both of the story in Daniel and in the Halacha, that statue 60 cubits high made out of pure gold is a classic form of idolatry. They're being asked to bow down to it. They refuse, willing to give up their life, establish a precedent in history of this notion of lamut al kiddush Hashem, to die for the sanctification of God's name rather than worship idols. Part one. That's the easy one. Where it gets more complicated is the same story that is addressed in a famous piece in the Gemara in Psachim, source 4, which seems to read the story a little more, with a little more subtlety. So the Gemara there is discussing a particular drasha from an individual by the name of Todos Ish Romi, Theodosius of Rome. Who he was and what he was, whether he was a great man, whether he was a Roman, this whole discussion in the Gemara and Psachim. But there the Gemara says, Od zu derash todos ish Romi. This too was taught by Todos Ish Romi. Ma ra'ach Hananiah Mishael v'Azariah shemesu atzmam al kedushat Hashem l'kivshan ha'esh. What did Hananiah Mishael and Azariah see that led them to be willing to throw themselves into the furnace for the sake of the sanctification of God's name? What did they see? What was their thought process? What was their analysis that led them to that conclusion? Nasu kal v'chomer be'atzmam mitzvah de'im. They took a page out of this week's parsha. They drew an a fortiori inference from the plague of the next week's parasha, actually, I should say, the plague of the frogs. And they said the following. The frogs of Egypt, matzvardim she'en mitzuvim l'kedushat Hashem, the frogs of Egypt were not commanded to die for the sake of the sanctification of God's name. And yet it says about them, uvao v'alu b'veitecha v'tanurecha v'mishavotecha, that they will come up and enter into your houses, your bedchambers, and your servants' houses, and your ovens and your kneading bowls. When are the kneading bowls found next to the oven? When do you put dough next to an oven? When the oven's hot. And these frogs are jumping into the dough and jumping into the ovens. That's equivalent to jumping into the furnace of Nebuchadnezzar. But they're not even commanded for Kiddush Hashem. Anu, we, says Hananiah Mishael v'Azariah, shemitzuvino kedushat Hashem, were commanded concerning the sanctification of God's name. How much more so alachat kama v'kama? That's the Gemara. Now, you understand that the context here of this medrash is very metaphorical. It's very philosophical. Nobody's suggesting for a moment that the Hananiah Mishael v'Azariah sat there and analyzed the frogs of Egypt, of whether or not they were analyzing the mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem. But the concept here is that they looked to the story of the plagues of Egypt, and particularly the story of the frogs, as a kind of a precedent to say to them, to inspire them, and say, we need to make a public demonstration before all of above, just as the plagues of Egypt did in Mitzrayim, and therefore we are going to not bow down to this idol. Okay, so here's my question, and this is the question that's asked by Tosfot. This Gemara starts with a the following statement. Ma'ra uchananya mishal vazayish masuots mama kedushat Hashem. What lesson, what thought process, what analysis did Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah go through to conclude that they were to sacrifice themselves for the sake of God's name? Rashi, Tosa quotes Rashi, understands the question as, what thought process did they go through to suggest that rather than, let's start from the beginning. Okay, I'm going to stop sharing for a second so I can see people. Right. Let's start from the beginning. We have a notion of these are the commandments that God has given us for chai behem that we should live by. Says the Gemara, v'chai behem v'lo shemut behem, the mitzvot are given to live by and not to die by. Therefore, we have a concept of pikuach nefesh. Right? Saving lives overrides everything else. The Gemara, Rabbi Akiva in particular, darshans three exceptions to that rule. They are the big three, as we call them. Says Rashi, there's basically two lessons here, two phrases here. V'chai behem, you shall live by them, and when it comes to the big three, Yehareg, you should allow yourself to be killed rather than violate Yehareg v'al yavor. What is it about this story that led Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah to interpret it as a moment of self-sacrifice, Yehareg v'al yavor, rather than you shall live by them, v'chai behem pikuach nefesh, says Rashi. And then the Gemara continues from there. However, immediately on that Gemara, and you'll forgive me for getting a little bit more halachic in this discussion than biblical text analysis, but I think it's important. Tosfot raises the following question. He says, v'kashe, dabe fahes yahavo. Says Tosfot, Benutam, I don't understand Rashi, I don't understand the Gemara. If you're looking at this from a halachic perspective, from every vantage point, they're obligated to give their life. First of all, it's idolatry. And second of all, it's in public. So even if you wanted to take the argument that maybe it was not such an idolatrous thing, or maybe they could have escaped from themselves, or maybe they could have found an excuse, or maybe they could have not been there, or maybe they could have found some other way around it. Nonetheless, this was in public. Difarhestia. And there's another concept that in public, if the nations have come to us and say in public, we need to violate the Torah in order to demonstrate that the Torah is no longer valid and relevant, then that's even more significant than idolatry. So Tosfot is bothered by the whole circumstances of this analysis. And therefore, here is Rabbeinu Tam. And here Rabbeinu Tam says something extraordinary, which we are going to need to understand. And again, I've translated what I have. I've put on the source page the translations of those things that I have access to. Otherwise, I'm just going to translate as we go. Rabbeinu Tam, who happens to be Rashi's grandson, says the following. Titzelem ze shasan Nebuchadnezzar, this statue that Nebuchadnezzar established. Here's the bombshell. Ready? Lav avodah zarah was not idolatrous. Not idolatrous. So we can drop the entire conversation about idolatry. It's not relevant to the subject of Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. Their refusal to bow down to this statue had nothing to do with idolatry, claims Rabbeinu Tam, because this is not an idol. Now, you'll ask me the obvious question. If it's not an idol, I don't know, big gold statue, 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide, made out of pure gold. Sounds like a golden statue to me. Right? It sounds like an idol to me. If it's not an idol, what is it? That's the question. Says Rabbeinu Tam, it's not idolatry. What is it? Andarta she'asa lichvod atzmo. Nebuchadnezzar made a monument to himself. A monument to himself. What is a monument to the king, 60 amot, 60 cubits high, that's 10 stories high? What does a 10-story high monument to the king made of pure gold look like? I don't know. What do you think it looks like? 60 cubits high, 6 cubits wide, monument of pure gold made to honor the king. And want to venture a guess at what they think it looks like? I'm going to take a guess. I have no idea. We have no idea what this thing looks like. But I'm going to take a guess that it looks an awful lot like Nebuchadnezzar. A fair guess, right? A monument to the glory, the honor of the king is not an idol. It's a statue of the king. Now, are you allowed to bow down to a king?
Yes.
Bow down to a king? Yes. Are you allowed to bow down to a king's representative?
Yes.
Yes. That's the whole question about Mordechai and Haman, right? That he was the king's representative. She allowed to bow down to a king, allowed to bow down to the king's representative. He says to us, not so far-fetched to suggest that you're allowed to bow down to the king's monument. The fact that it's made out of gold is irrelevant. It's not there to represent an idol. It's not there to represent a deity. It's there to represent the king. And therefore, from a purely halachic perspective, says Rabbeinu Tam, the technicalities of Yareg Valyavor and idolatry and whether it is idolatry and not idolatry are not relevant because this is not about idols. This is about honoring Nebuchadnezzar, acknowledging Nebuchadnezzar's authority. If you go back to what we had originally suggested, that this whole statue was there in order to counter the dream in which he saw a vision of the fall of Bavel, and he wanted this dream to represent the kind of the eternity of Bavel. So it's even more so. He built a statue to represent the Bavel. Who represents Bavel more than the king? And therefore, says Tosfot, Lechach Ka'amar Ma'ra'u, and it comes back to the textual issue related to the Gemara. I'm going to skip that for a second. But he has a very interesting textual analysis in the Pasuk. The Pasuk says, let's go back to the text for a second. Pasuk Yudchet. Ve'im lo, yadua yelecha melech, she'et elohecha en anachnu ovdim, ulepesel hazahav asher itzabto lo nishtachabeh. We will not serve your gods. And we will not bow down to your idols. Says Tosfot, is that the same thing written twice? Or are those two separate statements? Says Hanani Mishael of Azariah, we're not going to bow down to your gods, nor are we going to bow down to your statues. But those are two separate things. And that's exactly what Tosfot says. Therefore, Tosfot works off the Aramaic, V'chein mashma midichtiv le'lahach le'et enchana palachin, we will not serve your gods. Uletzelem didaba lonis god, nor will we worship or bow down to your golden statues. Mashma dela di David salma tremilinu. It seemed that they're two different things. There's a god. There are idols. That wasn't in the conversation, but they threw it in there for the sake of kind of rounding off the issue, the conversation. But the bigger issue is we will not bow down even to a golden statue which was designed as a monument to the king. All right. So that's the story of Hanani Mishael of Azariah. According to Tosfot, if I ask the question, is this idolatry? The answer is no. But then that on the one hand, that explains one half of the story and makes the other half of the story even more complicated. Because it might explain, and again, this is a different opinion than the one we saw at the beginning of the year. In the beginning of the year, we saw the sources that say it's idolatry, classic. Hanani Mishael of Azariah were right. This is classic idolatry. On the other hand, if I suggest now, as Tosfot is suggesting, that it's not really classic black and white idolatry, it's more like it's a monument to the king. It's a monument to Nebuchadnezzar's glory and honor and statue, etc. If that's the issue, and it's not idolatry, then what's the problem?
Would you see this as Washington's monument?
Say that again?
Would you see this as comparable to Washington's monument, that tall,
I would see it more comparable to Lincoln's memorial, because okay. I think it looks more like Nebuchadnezzar. I don't think it's a statue. I think it's an actual image of Nebuchadnezzar. But the bigger question for us is, so why did Hanani Mishael of Azariah put their lives on the line and refuse to bow down. If it's not idolatry, what are they doing?
Rabbi, perhaps it can be an idolatry because it's fact sensitive, whether it constitutes worship or prayer. And does that fact sensitivity of worship or prayer depend on an objective or subjective perspective? Is it private or communal?
Fair analysis. And what, whether or not, kind of to take what you're suggesting and weave it into what we're going to discuss momentarily. But at the end of the day, you understand that the moment you've raised that variable, and that's exactly the question, are there other variables here that are open to interpretation? Because as we saw from the beginning, the big issue here is Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refused to bow down. What about the rest of the people? Did they bow down? What about Daniel, who's not in the story? Did he bow down? What about, we know at the time there was a great Navi who lived in Babel by the name of Yechezkel. Where was he in the story? All of the nations invited. Medrash will throw Yechezkel and Daniel into the conversation in a few minutes. But we understand that the moment it's subjective, if the moment there's a variable to perceive, to look at, that's not black and white, it's not clear that it's idolatry, suddenly there's room for a conversation. Okay, what's happening in this story?
Well, don't they call it a pesel?
Excuse me?
They call it a pesel.
Pesel can be anything.
Is lo taseh kol pesel tmuna in the
right. In the context of representing a deity, that is correct. But if it's representing a king and it's then the idea is to bow down to a king or to acknowledge the honor to the king, again, this is what gets subtle, but it becomes open to interpretation. Not black and
it's
white.
It's not called a pesel, it's called a tselem.
And in this particular case, it's called a tselma, right? Which is a tselem. It comes to the same issue, which is that there's a subjective variable going on, and that's the variable that we need to analyze. So if I come back to the Rishonim, essentially in answer to this question, once we've established the position of Tosfot, which again is different from Rashi and different from other commentaries, but once we establish the position of Tosfot, that this is not idolatry, now we have to ask ourselves the question, okay, so maybe the rest of the Jewish people are right. Maybe Daniel is right. Maybe others were right. Maybe Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were wrong. You can ask the same question, by the way, about Mordechai and Megillat Esther, because all that Haman represented was the king. So if Mordechai refused to bow down to Haman, why? Because he was a Jew? Because you're not allowed to bow down to a human being? That's not true. Did Yosef's brothers not bow down to Yosef when they thought he was the viceroy of Egypt? The whole point of the dream was that you bow down to the king or to the king's representative. You're allowed to bow down to a king. You're allowed to bow down to a king's representative. So why did Mordechai refuse to bow down to Haman? Complicated. We can debate it. Not right. But the same issue exists here, although maybe a little bit less so because it's more concrete. There's more of an actual object rather than a person. But says Tosfot, that object is but an andarta. It's a monument. So the same issue would apply. So first of all, we need to understand that in the Middle Ages, there was a raging debate between, for the lack of a better term, we're going to call it Chachmei Ashkenaz and Chachmei Sfarad, between the scholars who lived in the world of influence of Ashkenazic Jewry and the scholars who lived in the world of Sephardic Jewry, and the Rambam in particular, over the question of if you are being put in a position where your life is being threatened over Jewish values that are not idolatry, are you allowed to voluntarily sacrifice your life or risk your life for the sake of standing up for Jewish values, even if they're not idolatry? If the halachic position was that you were allowed to violate Jewish law and save your life, and you choose voluntarily to stand on principle for Judaism and not violate, but rather give your life up for the sake of God, for the sake of Torah, are you allowed to do that? This was a major debate in the Middle Ages, and I'll show you two extreme positions. Let's start from the Rambam, which is the negative side. He writes, And the translation here is, I apologize, this is, it would be easy if this was side by side, but it's not. It's one under the other. So if you have the source page, you can scroll yourself, you can scroll down to the English. Kol Beit Yisrael mitzuvim al kiddush Hashem. Every member of the household of Israel is commanded with regard to the sanctification of God's name, al kiddush Hashem agdol hazeh, she'ne'emar v'niktashti b'toch b'nei Yisrael. We are obligated to sanctify God's name. We are prohibited from from desecrating God's name. What is this case? If a idolatrous king or leader or person would get up and say, and force Israel, or force a member of the Jewish people to violate any of the mitzvot of the Torah that are not of the big three, okay, or he will be killed. He should allow himself, he should violate rather than allow himself to be killed, because it's not one of the big three. As it says, you have to live by the commandments, and not die by the commandments. And I'll come back to this line in a second. And Allah Chabet, that applies to other mitzvot, but not to the big three. But if it comes to idolatry, murder, and adultery, those three are what we call the big three. Yehareg v'al yavor, they are, you have to be willing to give your life up. And for all kinds of reasons, which are not a discussion for now. But the Rambam adds a line. If he stands on principle and allows himself to die and not violate where he's permitted to do so, to violate the law, he is guilty for his own demise, meaning he has sacrificed himself unnecessarily and unjustifiably, says the Rambam. An extraordinary debate. The Ashkenazic scholars, and there's a lot of history here, and historians will analyze this debate. There's much to be said, and I think intuitively we understand the circumstances in which Jews in Europe lived, which was very different from at the time than Jews in Sephardic communities. Not our subject for this course, but we can all understand where it's coming from. Says, I'll give you one example, which is the Rosh Mishans, 12th century. Going back to the Gemara that we saw earlier, Theodosius of Rome, and the Gemara says, what did Hanani Mishael of Azaria see that they had to draw an inference from the frogs? Says Tosfos Shantz, question we've never asked. Why didn't Hanani Mishael of Azaria just run? Hide! What do they have to stand there in plain sight in the middle of the courtyard for everybody to see and stand in opposition to Nebuchadnezzar and cause this great wrath? Why don't you run? They could have run away. And look what he says. Kamosha said Daniel. You know why Daniel's not on the story, says the Tosfos Shantz? Because he ran away. He got smart. He wasn't going to be there in public. So he went hiding. I have a different interpretation of why Daniel wasn't there, but we'll come to it B'Zrat Hashem next week. But nonetheless, that's what he says. And he goes to the Hogamah and Psachim, and he says that it's not really idolatry. It's really, he takes this position of Tosfot, it's not really idolatry. But nonetheless, there was a sanctification of God's name. Why? They were so connected to God and so connected to spirituality and so connected to their Torah and to their covenant with God and to their position and to their life as Jews. They could not see themselves, even if permissible, they could not see themselves bowing down to anything other than to God. Permissible to bow down to the king? They couldn't do it. Permissible to bow down to the king's idol, to the king's statue? They couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. And so therefore, Hanani Mishael of Azariah's actions, says Tosfos Shantz, were totally voluntary. They didn't have to. They wanted to. Why? Because they were so moved, so inspired, that they could not bring themselves to bow down to anything other than to God. And it connected to the story of Avram, but that's about Midrash. We're going to leave that for now. So you understand that Tosfos Shant is built off this Ashkenazic position that even though they're not obligated to give of their lives, they are entitled, they're allowed to voluntarily for the sake of their own personal religious fervor. The Rambam argues that that is not the case, that you're not allowed to voluntarily give up your life for your own religious fervor. So what does the Rambam do with the story of Hanani Mishael Vazaria? Says the Rambam, there's another category in conversation here. As somebody said earlier, there's a lot of subjective categories that can play a role here, even if it's not black and white. And that is what is referred to in the halacha as Shat Hashmad, where the intention of the idolatrous despot who is forcing us to violate Jewish law is not because they want us to worship their God, but because they want us to give up our religious identity. Im nitkaven la'aviro al mitzvot bilvad. If his intention is, sorry, let me skip to halacha gimel. Kol ha'dvarim eilu shelo b'shat ha'gzeirah. Aval b'shat ha'gzeirah, at a time of public decree, where the decree is designed to create a oppression against the Jewish people, where the decree is designed to get us to publicly deny our association with God and with Torah and with Jewish life, even if it's not over idolatry, even if it's over Shabbos, which is not one of the big three, or over any other aspect, or kashrus, or any other aspect of Jewish life. But if it's a public decree of the king, then Behushi Amod Melech Vashav, for example, an evil king, in Nebuchadnezzar, and the Rambam identifies Nebuchadnezzar v'chaverah, and will decree anything to force Israel to give up their loyalty to Torah. Then the big three is not the issue. Then you're obligated to allow yourself to sacrifice yourself for the sake of defending the integrity of Judaism and the integrity of Torah. So I'll come back to this question. And what you're basically dealing with from both perspectives, both the Rashi Mishnayos and the Rambam, is a conclusion that this statue is not classic idolatry. It's a monument. It's a representative of the king. It's some other aspect. It's some other message that challenges our loyalty to God. So go back to what we said initially, which was that the statue represents Nebuchadnezzar, or even looks like Nebuchadnezzar, or represents in Nebuchadnezzar's mindset a challenge to his dream. And in the previous chapter, we had a dream about the statue with various medals, and the gold represented Nebuchadnezzar and represented Bavel, and the future kingdoms represented the other medals to come. So Nebuchadnezzar's response was to build the statue all of gold, as if to say, I'm going to reign forever. So there's a theological messaging in his statue, even if it's not idolatry. Hanani Mishael Vazaria looked at that message and said, that message is antithetical to Judaism. That message is the equivalent of, to the Rambam's language, Gishat HaGzerat, the king's decree. Because to claim our loyalty to God, to Nebuchadnezzar, is to challenge our loyalty to God. And they said no. Now, is that interpretation the only interpretation we could offer to Nebuchadnezzar's statue? Could we find a way to justify bowing to Nebuchadnezzar's statue within the confines of halacha that wouldn't be theologically challenging to Judaism? Sure, we could, based on this Tosfos. And so maybe that's what's going on within the context of the Jewish people. You have Nebuchadnezzar, you have Daniel, you have Yechezkel, you have the Jewish people. You've got a raging debate. Since when is any decision of any Jewish leader universally accepted by all of the leaders of the Jewish people? So Hanani Mishael Bar Azariah stood up and said, no. And everybody else said, you're crazy. Everybody else said, this isn't idolatry. You're giving your life for nothing. This is nothing. This is meaningless. And they said, no, it's not meaningless. It's the core of our identity here as Jews. Hanani Mishael Bar Azariah, you're such extremists. And back and forth. And that's precisely, says Tosfot, the debate between, or the Rosh Mishans, between Daniel and the Chezkel and the Jewish people and Hanani Mishael Bar Azariah. That's two positions or two ways of looking at this context of Tosfos' suggestion that in fact the statue is not idolatry, but a monument to the honor of the king. I want to share with you one more variation, and that will sort of bring the shiur today to a close. One more variation, which I think has some really interesting ramifications for us. So I'm just going to go back to sharing for a second. Sorry, I've got to get the right buttons here.
Share screen. Could the debate not be about with Daniel and Yechezkel, but with Jews who didn't want to give up their lives, not regarding the cross?
I mean, the ramification.
In other words, should Jews martyr themselves because of not worshipping the crucifix, or should they not?
Right. No, I 100%. What I'm suggesting here is just the tip of the iceberg. If our subject was history, from this debate between the Tosfos Shantz and the Rambam, you can go into a historical analysis of Christian Europe and persecution under the cross versus other historical arenas and circumstances we've lived in. There's a lot of history in this story. For our purposes and for the time frame that we're in, it's not my field of expertise to be able to speak to that from a historical perspective. And so I leave that to the academics and the historians. I really want to come back to the world of Tanakh. But you are correct. This is a very relevant debate in the Middle Ages, which is why it's so intense between the Ashkenazic Poskim and the Sephardic Poskim. But I want to show you this Nemuka Yosef, because this Nemuka Yosef does something very interesting. Nemuka Yosef is a Sephardic scholar, 14th century, student of the Ran, and certainly of the school of reason of the Rambam, etc. Nemuka Yosef throws in a monkey wrench. And he says the following. He says, HaMakadeshet Hashem u'maser atzmon l'mita k'dishat shemo mitzvotav. If you sanctify God's name and give your life up for the sanctification of God and his mitzvot, the verse in Tehillim is ascribed to you. Gather my pious ones together, isfuli chasidai, korte briti, those who make a covenant with me, for the sake of sacrifice. Whereas, if the halacha is that you should violate and not allow yourself to be killed because it's not idolatry, then you should not violate, he should not sacrifice, and he should not let his life be forfeit. And if he does, the language here is identical to the Rambam. However, he adds the following. But if the individual in question is a great, pious, God-fearing person, and he sees that the generation is a generation that has begun to breach a particular mitzvah or a particular aspect of Jewish law, they're not part of the big three. And that's the subject at which the risk here, the challenge of risking your life is posed. He is permitted to sacrifice his life even for a lesser mitzvah, so that the people should see and learn to fear God and to love God with all their hearts. To see this sacrifice as a kind of an inspiration for the generation. So Nemuka Yosef throws in here and he connected directly to the story of the Andarta, of Hanani Mishael Bar Azariah and the statue, which was not an idolatrous statue, but rather a monument to the kings. And nonetheless, Because most people looked at the statue and most people saw it as a form of idolatry. Therefore, even though it wasn't, they were willing to sacrifice their lives. In other words, what Nebuka Yosef is suggesting is, even within the perspective of the Rambam and the Ran and the Sephardic position that you're not allowed to voluntarily give up your life for the sake of Torah unless it's one of the big three, there comes a point in which there are certain leadership roles in the Jewish people, a person of great piety, a person of great fear of heaven, a person who's seen in a leadership role, and he sees that there's a particular weakness in the generation, a breach in Jewish law. That breach is what's at stake here. They're willing to give up their lives even if it's not required.
And Yecheskel and Daniel were not?
Oh, so that's the big question. Is what he's suggesting is a matter of perspective and understanding. Did Yecheskel and Daniel agree with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah's position? Did they agree with their interpretation? So now, this opens up for us a whole new perspective, which is, what is it about the generation that Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah saw or perceived or thought they saw? And what is it about the generation that the other leaders may not have seen? Now we're into a different level of interpretation. So this is what we're going to pick up next week. So this question that the Mukha Yosef raises has enormous ramifications for us. What was the nature of that generation? The generation that stood in Bavel, the generation that the Gemara said in Megillah worshipped idols in the days of Nebuchadnezzar, what were they really like? What was their philosophy? What was their theology? They come to Yechezkel. Yechezkel is their spiritual leader. What did Yechezkel tell them? What did they tell him back? What was going on at that moment in history, to which Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah stepped into the breach and said, we're drawing a line in the sand, obligated or not. This can't continue. We're drawing a line in the sand. That's my question that we're going to, and I want to understand from this chapter. It's kind of a window into a whole perspective on what was that generation, what was the theology of that generation, what was the philosophy, and why was it so, a handful of years after the destruction of the temple, that idolatry is such a rampant, relevant issue. So we're going to explore this question and kind of bring this subject to a close, B'ezrat Hashem, next week, kind of pull this piece together. And that will be our springboard to understanding the rest of Sefer Daniel, and really a springboard into understanding the rest of the time frame of the generation of the exile of Babel, Persia, and even up until the time of the Greeks. This is where it starts. So thank you for listening. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you coming on board. And for those of you who are returning, I hope you enjoyed it. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, I hope you enjoy. B'ezrat Hashem, next week we will continue.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Very well.
Thank you, Rabbi.
A very interesting.
My class. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Rabbi Shulman, maybe we'll just let the newcomers know that you are generally here 10 to 15 minutes in advance of the start of class, at which time you usually have taken a look at the chat from the previous week in case anybody had questions that went unanswered. So I will make sure to send you a copy of this week's chat so that you can take a look at the comments in case, like I said, there were any questions that went unanswered.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Okay.
Thank you. Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. Enjoy. We'll see you next week.
Thank you. I hope next week you'll tell us what Rabbeinu Tam thought about martyrdom.
What he thought about?
Martyrdom.
Well, all the Chashmei Ashkenaz, the Ashkenazic position from the Balei HaTosfot was consistent. They thought that it was that even if it wasn't obligated, it was permissible to give your life for the sake of the sanctification of God's name. It's this issue between Chachmei Ashkenaz and Chachmei Sfarad is pretty consistent.
So they were French and therefore Sephardim.
It doesn't really work. Geography works differently in those days, but there were
unintended.
Rashi was French more, too, but he was
exactly. It's more about the school of frame of reference in terms of scholarship and learning, and the influence of what we call Chachmei Ashkenaz, sort of the Ashkenazic influence of Jewish law, comes from German scholars, and then from there to France and parts of Spain too. It really is about the school and the Midrash. It's a complicated story, but
yeah. And if you look at the Kinnas from Tisha B'Av, there's many horrific stories about the people taking their lives and stuff like that.
For sure, for sure. Yeah.
No, so when Moshe and Aaron go into their audience with Paro, do they have to bow down? What was the norm in front of the greatest king?
I don't know what the norm was, but I can tell you that if it was required, they would have done so. In other words, or they could have done so. Let me put it that way. I don't know. But Yaakov certainly bows down to Paro. The brothers certainly bow down to Yosef. It's not considered abnormal, and it's not considered a violation of Jewish law.
It's an act of reverence. Yes.
Yeah. Honor to the king's person. So, this is exactly the debate. Yeah. Okay. Wonderful. We'll see you all next week.
Shabbat Tov.